This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today, we'll continue to look into protests happening in Northern California following the killing of George Floyd, and at some in the North State that will not be happening due to a fear of possible violence. We'll also hear about new research that says those who think the coronavirus is extremely infectious might have a fatalistic view, leading them to be less likely to follow public health guidelines. If you have questions for us, let us know on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, some news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. Another 35 deaths were attributed to the coronavirus in the state, according to information released Tuesday by the California Department of Public Health. It was the lowest daily figure in weeks, though the rate of infections shows no sign of abating. The department confirmed 2,304 new infections Tuesday, sending the total in California to 115,310. The number of patients is rising at a rate of 19% per week. The death toll from the virus in California reached 4,286. New cases of COVID-19 also continue appearing in the North State, with new infections confirmed in Siskiyou and Tehama counties, pushing the region's caseload to 214. Butte County now has the most in the region at 51. Two patients were released from hospitals there, leaving only a single patient under direct medical care. Sutter County is reporting 46 cases, Shasta County is reporting 39 cases, Yuba County reports 30 cases, Glenn 17, Siskiyou 8, Colusa 7, Tehama 6, Lassen 5, Plumas 4, while Trinity County continues reporting just one case. A Trinity County Sheriff's deputy has been placed on administrative leave after officials were alerted to what a department press release referred to as an inappropriate post made by a deputy on their private social media account. An investigation by the sheriff's office has been initiated, according to the release, which referred to the deputy's actions as discriminatory. A screenshot of the alleged post shows a heavyset, naked African-American man photoshopped in the place of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd with the words, "Quit resisting." NSPR was unable to verify the post as a message left with the sheriff's office was not returned, but KRCR-TV has reported that the sheriff's office has confirmed the image. On Tuesday, members of the California Assembly Black Caucus condemned the death of George Floyd, saying the injustice has roots originating in the nation's early history. Assemblywoman Shirley Weber represents San Diego and chairs the caucus.
This pandemic of hate has spread across the nation to every small city in America. And we either are going to face it and fight it, or we will find ourselves once again in the same position we have been before.
The caucus's legislative agenda includes reinstating affirmative action, reducing high court fees, establishing a commission to justify reparations, and affirming a right to housing for women and children in California. Chico State University officials are awaiting word from Cal State leaders in Long Beach about plans to hold some in-person classes in the fall. In an email distributed to campus addresses Monday, CSU Chico President Gail Hutchinson said a detailed proposal was submitted calling for about a tenth of classes to meet in person. The campus is not planning on offering discounted tuition. Earlier plans called for instruction to continue exclusively online. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Protests are continuing across the country following the killing of George Floyd on Memorial Day by police in Minneapolis. In California, Los Angeles, and the Bay Area have seen thousands take to the streets. Further north in Sacramento, a curfew was issued Monday night in response to violence and vandalism during the protests over the weekend. On Monday night, at least 50 people were arrested, mostly for curfew violations in the city. For more on that story, we'll turn to our partners at Cap Radio.
With Cap Radio News, I'm Steve Milne. Protesters marched throughout downtown Sacramento last night, but the immediate outcome was very different than this past weekend when people broke into businesses and stole things, and standoffs took place between police and demonstrators. Cap Radio's Ezra David Romero has been covering the protests, and he joins us now. Hey, Ezra.
Hey, Steve.
How did last night differ from the past weekend?
Well, this weekend, a bunch of stuff happened, right? Like, businesses all over downtown and midtown Sacramento were vandalized. You know, if you take a drive through downtown on J Street or L Street, you'll see a bunch of businesses boarded up, both because windows are broken and also because people are just taking precaution. Last night was very peaceful. You know, it started out with a prayer gathered at Cesar Chavez Plaza in downtown Sacramento. It started out with a group of Native American people with prayer and song. You know, that prayer meeting lasted about 2 hours, and then they took to the street.
But during that prayer meeting, a curfew was announced. So how did people respond to that?
Well, the curfew meant that no one on streets after 8 p.m. Otherwise, they could spend the night in jail and get a fine of about $1,000 or both. The curfew was announced around 5:30 or 6. You know, I heard a mixture of things from people. You know, some knew it was coming and left the protest early because they wanted to go home, but others were surprised, like Alicia Cooper. She works at P.F. Chang's, which is broken into Sunday night. She spent the day cleaning the restaurant and said she had some questions, like, why wasn't there an advance notice?
I didn't know there was a curfew until about half an hour ago when one of my friends, I was on my Facebook Live, and she's like, hey, curfew's at 8. I was like, oh, well, thank you for letting me know, because I've been out all day cleaning the city, and if the city doesn't know, how am I supposed to know?
Yeah, you know, she wanted about a 24-hour notice, and she thought, like, that would have been good since there was potential arrests and National Guard and things like that out. You know, others like Sarah Lee just ignored the announcement. Sarah's a social worker, and she's lived in Sacramento for a long time.
You said you don't care about the curfew. Why is that?
Because I'm a taxpayer, and these are our streets.
What is this moment about for you?
It's been going on too long. I mean, hundreds of years, but, I mean, in my lifetime, my whole lifetime, the same thing. We're tired of it.
Ezra, how did the march go? I understand it was more peaceful than past protests.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the result of two things. You know, the first thing is that there was a military and police presence on many of the streets. So I think people just didn't feel comfortable venturing near them. They had guns, there were tanks, and there were jeeps. You know, and secondly, Stevante Clark at some point started leading the march. Clark, you know, he's the brother of Stephon Clark, who was killed by Sacramento police in 2018. You know, he was holding a cell phone when he was shot in his grandmother's yard. Here's a bit of what he led.
Stephon Clark!
Eric Garner! Sean Bell! So he did this thing multiple times where he had the crowd take a knee, put their cell phones up, and then take a moment of silence. I don't know if it was exactly a tactic, but it seemed to calm the crowd. Also, people shamed those that climbed on the tanks and jeeps. They were yelling at them and telling them that's not what we're about. You know, Clark also had a few things to say. You know, he's calling for change. You know, mostly he wants the resignation or firing of District Attorney Marie Ann Schubert. Here's a bit more of what he had to say.
So we need actionable items. Yes. Actionable items, what that means is we could protest and whatnot, but what are we asking for, okay? That's what we need now. We have needs. Stop. You guys know my agenda. I want justice for my brother. Y'all all know that.
Uh-huh. Well, Ezra, how did the night end?
It ended pretty peacefully where it began at Cesar Chavez Plaza. You know, they had wanted to go to the jail to make a point there, but it was barricaded off and there was a line of people, a line of officers. They hung out at the park for a while and then asked everybody to go home so there wouldn't be too many arrests or loss of life.
It's over. They are closing in on us. Please go home. Our peaceful demonstration is over. You will not win against bullets.
You know, I think some people were arrested. I saw on Twitter from other media outlets that stayed later that people were arrested. But when I left about 10:30, there were only a few groups out there. But I wanted to make one point pretty clear before we go. You know, I talked to a couple people during the march, and one conversation stuck out to me. I was talking to these two ladies about why all this matters, and I think their answer hits it spot on. Here's Solana Cranenberg from Sacramento.
It made me emotional the first day they protested. I have a 2-year-old son. I can just imagine what he's going to grow up to be like and how this world might be when he gets older. Like, I worry about my son. I worry about myself. I worry about my brothers, my friends, my cousins. Yeah. This is not cool.
You know, they told me they think this moment here in Sacramento and nationally has grown so big because of what happened to George Floyd and because, you know, things like this have happened here in our recent history in Sacramento.
We have plenty of protests in Sacramento, and like they said on the news, they've never seen nothing like this because we're tired. It's always a black person being hurt or degraded by police for who knows what matter it is, but I feel really strong about it.
All right, Ezra, thank you.
No problem.
That was CAP Radio's Steve Milne and Ezra David Romero speaking Tuesday about the latest on protests happening in Sacramento following the killing of George Floyd and the city's newly implemented curfew. Regionally over the weekend and Monday, peaceful marches and rallies have taken place in communities like Redding, Red Bluff, Oroville, and Chico. But many demonstrations planned for later in the week have now been canceled. According to the Reading Record Searchlight, a protest scheduled there for 6:30 Tuesday evening, starting in the Kohl's parking lot, was postponed with the exact reason unclear, although the paper reports City Manager Barry Tippin said the city had received comments from people concerned that the peaceful march would turn violent, with some community leaders voicing concern about it being hijacked. In Chico, separate demonstrations organized throughout the week by different groups were canceled due to fear of violence against protesters. This includes a rally where organizers hope to bring additional scrutiny to the case of Desmond Phillips, a 25-year-old black man who was suffering from a mental health crisis and who was fatally shot by Chico police officers on March 17, 2017. The demonstration was called off early in the day due to alleged violent threats posted on social media. For more, NSPR's Mark Albert spoke with Rain Schur of the Justice for Desmond organizing team.
Our original plan was to have people rally outside of city council, practicing distancing from each other for public health concerns in order to draw attention to the need for the city of Chico Police Department to become compliant with AB 392, which went into effect on January 1st. With this new law, there has been some change to the requirement for use of force policy, and currently the Chico PD use of force policy is non-compliant with AB 392. We also want to...
Does AB 392 have a phase-in period?
Not as such that I know of.
Okay.
I know that other cities across the state have already been working on this, and that has been in coordination with the regional state ACLU.
Okay. So it's what are the main changes, or what's one change about AB 392 that you think is really important and that you're looking forward to, that you think that makes real change that they're dragging their feet on?
Generally speaking, AB 392 does not make a very big change. The police union was able to put pressure on legislators in order to water down that law. However, it is a small step in the right direction that slightly increases the requirement for when deadly force is used, and that is what we want to see happen. Chico PD currently uses use of force policy that was created by a corporation called Lexapol, and Lexapol's policy is non-compliant with AB 392. In addition to that, we would have been reiterating and amplifying our call to fire the officers who killed Desmond Phillips, as well as the other officers who have killed people on the Chico police force. We saw very quickly that the officers who killed George Floyd were fired, and we want to see that happening across the country, including here. The city of Chico does not have the power to prosecute those officers, but they are city employees, and the city could fire them so that they are no longer in that position of power.
And you've had to call this demonstration off.
Yes, we have canceled the rally that we were organizing for city council due to a variety of and increasing concerns about potential violence, about people showing up wanting to oppose us and possibly do violence to our folks and our supporters. And we were not equipped to keep people safe. We do not have any trust in the police keeping us safe. And therefore, it was the responsible thing to do to cancel our event.
In a town that's 85% white, with such a large majority.
Yeah.
Do you find it disturbing that you don't even feel safe to have a demonstration?
Of course it's disturbing, and it is not surprising. Even liberal white people in Chico don't realize how few Black people are here and how marginalized and unsafe they are on a daily basis in this town. Chico has a long history of a presence of white supremacists, both explicitly and implicitly. And with the just the statistics, like what you said, it is not surprising at all. It is sad that we don't have the numbers to be able to be safe on a basic level to show up and have Black people's voices be heard. And that's just the reality that we live in a county and a city that is so vastly majority white and so minority Black.
Rain, is there anything else you want to add or any good questions I should have asked and haven't?
We also want to be clear that Justice for Desmond is not involved in any events that are happening in Chico at this point. We want folks to know that any events in Chico that are using the name or the cause of Justice for Desmond, we appreciate anyone supporting us and uplifting Desmond Phillips' name, but we are not actually involved in any of the events that are currently being planned in Chico.
That was Rain Schur, part of the Justice for Desmond organizing team, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. Stay tuned. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. While protests and a focus on police violence and racial injustice continue throughout the nation, so does the coronavirus pandemic. And in the North State, after seemingly flattening the curve a few weeks ago, case numbers are starting to tick up. More testing, reopening, and a waning desire to follow public health guidelines could all be playing a role. And new research suggests not following guidelines could actually have to do with misinformed beliefs about the infectiousness of COVID-19, which leads people to take a fatalistic attitude to the virus, possibly foregoing things like hand washing and social distancing. NSPR's Andre Bayek recently spoke with Jesper Akeson, the lead author of the National Bureau of Economic Research working paper, Fatalism, Beliefs, and Behaviors During the COVID-19 Pandemic. Akeson worked with co-authors from the University of Oxford and Boston University, and he also is the managing director of The Behavioralist, a consulting firm based in London. Andre first asked Akeson about the questions he was seeking to answer.
So my co-authors and I set out to understand what people believe about the infectiousness of COVID-19, also how people's beliefs about the infectiousness influence their behavior, and also whether we can change these beliefs and improve their behavior. So in order to answer these questions, we conducted an experiment with about 3,600 people. Half were living in the US and about half in the UK. So we began by inviting participants to take part in an online survey. They weren't aware that this was an experiment of any sort. So we started the survey by asking them a few questions about their socioeconomic background and their beliefs about COVID-19. Once we'd done that, we moved on to then randomly allocating these survey participants to one of three groups. So one third was shown sort of like a poster with a lower bound expert estimate of the infectiousness of COVID-19. More specifically, we told them that, you know, studies had found that someone who contracts COVID-19 would, on average, infect two other people. Third was shown an upper bound expert estimate of the infectiousness of COVID-19. And there we said, you know, one person would, on average, infect five others. And then one third was just shown nothing. And they were asked to continue with the survey.
And what were some of your findings?
After we administered these treatments, we then measured their beliefs about the infectiousness of the virus, and then how willing they were to engage in various protective behaviors, such as, you know, hand washing or avoid seeing people in high-risk groups. And so we've had three main findings, I think, where the first one was that people are actually really misinformed about the virus. And so at the time of the experiment, which was sort of in late March, most experts estimated that one person would, on average, infect somewhere between one and six others if they contract the virus. However, in our experiment, we found that, on average, people believe that one person would infect 28 others. So that's a big discrepancy. Second, we found that it's possible to change people's beliefs about the virus by presenting them with these, you know, posters with statistics on them. I mean, in fact, showing these estimates or these posters revised people's beliefs about the infectiousness downward from around 28 to around 20. So there's still a big discrepancy between, you know, the kind of actual infectiousness and what they believed, but at least the posters brought them closer to that, you know, true number. And then finally, and perhaps most interestingly, we found that believing that COVID-19 is more infectious makes people, on average, less willing to engage in various protective behaviors, such as hand washing or avoid seeing people in high-risk groups. And then we also found that the more infectious people believe that COVID-19 is, the more pessimistic they become about their future. So this is something we call a fatalism effect. In other words, you know, people might be thinking that, you know, oh, COVID-19 is really infectious, which means I'm going to get it anyway, so why bother with any of these protective behaviors? This is, of course, like, you know, not a good take, and it's very dangerous to not do that. So it's an effect that has a big potential negative consequence for society.
And what are some of those potential negative consequences?
So just very simply put, I mean, if you don't want to wash your hands, you're more likely to contract the virus. You know, you're more likely to fall ill and also to infect others. It's very difficult to calculate exactly what fatalism might lead to. But, you know, we do know that at least the effect would be substantial enough to sort of lead to quite a few deaths actually across the states.
Did you learn anything about potentially changing people's beliefs about the virus and in turn changing their behaviors?
So we found that their beliefs were really off the mark when we conducted the survey, and showing people the posters did sort of correct a lot of people's beliefs. So beliefs were really scattered all over the place when we first asked the question about the infectiousness. And then after they had seen these posters, most people actually thought that the infectiousness was somewhere close to, like, you know, one person, it would infect somewhere between one and five other people. However, there were still some people that thought that the infectiousness, you know, was closer to like 100 or something like this, which meant that the average wasn't sort of brought down as much as we'd wanted to. But, you know, showing the posters did correct most people's beliefs. So it does work. I'm not sure if it works in the long run. I mean, it could very well be that we corrected people's beliefs for the duration of the survey, but then they go out in the world and speak to somebody and then change their mind again. But at least we know that it is possible to change them, at least for, you know, a short period of time.
As we stand today, many governments are exploring reopening or relaxing restrictions to perhaps stay at home. Can the fatalism effect be materialized in these situations we're seeing now, where restrictions are being lifted and people are going out and not heeding mitigation efforts such as social distancing and hand washing and things like that?
Sure. I mean, when we have stay-at-home orders, even those who feel fatalistic aren't able to fully act upon that impulse. I mean, they still have to stay at home and they aren't free to go and see their friends. However, you know, fatalism does become a much bigger problem once the orders are lifted, because then those who feel like, you know, I'm going to get it anyway and now have the freedom to act irresponsibly. In other words, I think that it's you know, once these stay-at-home orders have been relaxed, it becomes even more important to, you know, communicate with people and ensure that they understand that social distancing is important and also that what they do makes a difference.
You mentioned communication. I believe you noted that in your paper as well. Mm. This seems to be a key point in describing how the virus or the seriousness of the virus. What's the balance that should be taken from officials in communicating right. about the virus?
That's a very difficult question. I think our study doesn't necessarily answer that question, and I think that's something that future studies have to look into. I think really what we highlight is that there is a trade-off, right? So, you know, if you say that it is, you know, very infectious or very dangerous, you might make people feel more concerned and take the disease more seriously. But on the other hand, it might backfire by making people feel fatalistic. So it's really important that future studies investigate this, I think.
You also noted an economic interest. Can you explain what you found there?
Sure. I guess there are a couple of ways of looking at it. I mean, so one aspect is we just simply find that the more infectious you believe that COVID-19 is, the less optimistic you become. And there are quite a few studies done in the past that link your optimism to your investment and saving decisions. So it might be that, you know, sort of we see a reduction in economic behavior because of fatalism. But then I think the more important point is very simply, you know, fatalism makes people act more recklessly, and that causes damages in terms of health and well-being, and then ultimately also economic costs.
Could you maybe briefly go over maybe some of the limitations?
Sure. I mean, so I think the main limitation is that we're conducting this survey online and we're asking people about their intentions to do things. So we alter their beliefs and then we see what they say they will do. That doesn't necessarily mean that they will go and do that. So I think future studies should definitely try to conduct this type of research in the field where they actually record what people do. That's very difficult to do though, because for example, washing your hand is a very private behavior, right? Which is difficult to observe in a study.
And before I let you go, can I get you to maybe briefly summarize what we've learned through this conversation here and what you found in your paper?
Sure. I think the main takeaway is that policymakers have to think very carefully about the messages they convey. I mean, it's crucial that they stress the importance of social distancing and engaging in other important behaviors. But they have to do that in ways that do not induce feelings of fatalism or hopelessness. I believe a good way forward, and again, we don't explicitly test this in the experiment, is to just stress the seriousness of the situation, but also really emphasizing that, you know, what every individual does and what they choose makes a big difference for themselves and for others.
That was Jesper Akeson, the lead author of the National Bureau of Economic Research working paper titled Fatalism, Beliefs, and Behaviors During the COVID-19 Pandemic. He spoke with NSPR's Andre Bayek. And that is your program. As always, if you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.